This is a digital recording of the Academic Senate meeting of March 22nd, 2012.
All right. All right. Well, we're good to go. We're good. Great. Welcome, everybody. People in the room are ready for spring break. Show of hands. I do not have a report as term faculty, but I do have someone to introduce to you in lieu of your. I'd like to introduce Abel Ferion, who is responsible for the flyer at your place. Regarding the Mario Savio Memorial, and he has a few words to say.
Once again, my name is Abel Ferion, and we've been working on the Mario Savio Speaker's Corner for approximately a year and a half. So it's kind of exciting.
That's going to be really loud because it sucks to sound even here.
We've been working on the Mario Savio project for about a year and a half, and it was work before that too, because finally becoming something that's going to be done on campus. And to get it done on campus, we need some donations. And we're aware that students are not too well informed with Mario Savio. So what we plan to do as a student organization is to have a day where we could provide information from Mario Savio and be able to create that awareness of Mario Savio and why is this going to be good with it. But it signifies it's not just a speaker's corner for freedom of speech, but it's also a memory of Mario Savio, something that we teach you here. So it's kind of showing us that kind of aspect. And so basically, we are having April 12th at the Cooperage at 7 p.m. We're going to have a meeting there, a small conference, I guess. It's going to be approximately about 100 people. And we're going to be showing, we're going to have speakers there, personal speakers in New Mario Savio. We're going to have a 15-minute video. And we're going to have maybe some sketches of the drawings that are the work which is going to be done here. Between Stevenson and Student Union in the corner, where the trees, that's where the actual memorial is built. And so as of now, we have $10,000, about $10,000. And then we had our first person donate about $1,000. And we need some help to get this done here on campus. And that's how we came here and asked the support from faculty members and student members. And if you could possibly let your students know that we really need this to be done on campus, it would be great.
So just if you could help with the publicity and getting the word out to encourage students to come, for them the evening is probably mostly educational, and we're also inviting others from the community, the faculty, staff, and for those who would like to, there'll also be an opportunity to make donations. So if you could take this back to your department meeting, share it with colleagues, post it on the bulletin board, whatever you think the public has to look at. Thank you very much. And of course, you're all very much invited on that day as well. Some of you may even be contacted to give short testimonials to New Mario, and appreciate your assistance. Okay. And let me just say one thing. It took us years to get this re-energized. And really, it's been the efforts of Abel that have gotten this whole thing going, and certainly others have contributed a great deal, but really, he is the instigator, he's been the mover of that, and he's talked a lot about our students.
Yeah, the speaker already, but we haven't even approved the agenda yet, and we've got a time certain at 3:15, so I'm going to ask you questions. Can you address them to Senator Shan or to Abel himself?
Oh,
okay. I don't want to set a bad precedent for my first step.
I wouldn't mind.
So, moving along, we have two proxies that I know of. We have Nathan Rank for Senator Vogel. There he is. And we have Elaine Newman for Armand Jones. Thank you very much. We need to take a look at the agenda. Does anybody need a time certain?
I don't need a specific time, but I'd like to get a report to see if there's any.
Anything else?
I was hoping that we could, I hadn't heard whether or not the staff policy had a time certain, but we had folks who wanted to be here during that time in the first hour. So I'd asked for a 3:15, and I didn't know if it was possible. Had been made possible.
It's not printed on here, but it was on the agenda that I saw on the laptop.
So you were
on the agenda that
was
sent. So I'm assuming.
Okay, that's the time. Okay, thank you. Then I also need just for quick reports on other unrelated business.
What time? Or just to make sure.
Yeah, it's right. Yeah, just anyway, that's fine.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? Yes.
I don't need a time certain, but if I could have a time to do the report, it would be
great. You guys are trying to
make a motion. Just
okay. Anything else? Make your motion to approve the agenda.
So
moved. Great. Objections? All right. So we can take one quick look at the minutes of March 8th, which were emailed to you.
Yes, sir. I sent a couple of typos to Laurel, but as far as the funnies, I don't think Chair Ford said he was going to pummel our inboxes with humorous, scary, info appreciator type reminders or post the names of non-voters on the SSU Facebook page. And the first time there's two funnies, I believe. I'm not sure Deborah Roberts said they would be offering free colonoscopy.
I did see the triple. I thought perhaps if we could charge, we might solve the budget.
Where you send it?
Where's the only one of the two of you removed. Or should we remove the colonoscopy?
No, it should stay.
Can we approve these minutes? Any objections? Lovely. All right. So we are now ahead of correspondence. Can we do the consent items in 4 minutes? I think maybe so. We have two consent items, the revisions to the master's in family nurse practitioner program that's emailed to you, and the revision to the theater arts program. There's an information item that was sent with the new student theater reference code that's been written. Did we get that one? It's in the package. There we go. We'll close that so you can take a look at that. That's an information item. Comes to us as an information item. This is not one of our policies. Just so you can see that the work that we've done and that we have a new code on. The referendum.
Point of order?
Yes.
Is it in order to ask questions about it? The representative said this time?
Or not?
So I just had one question. Under the campaign guidelines and regulations, item D, it says campus organizations with an interest in the outcome of the student fee referendum may spend funds to support their position. But I thought that was where most of the controversy arose. And our last one, so I'm curious if why my interest was in that.
That was one of the most controversial pieces of this around our table and as I understand around the student privacy committee table. What it came down to is there wasn't a practical way to enforce it. We got into how do you decide how much each person can spend and who's in charge of keeping track of that? And then how do you, there's student groups and other special interest parties that we felt like the level of structure that would have to be put into place to be able to keep track of that and enforce that was problematic, and there wasn't really any enforcement method. We couldn't think of any good way of something to do to punish the people who didn't obey, if you will. And so we left it at, we thought it was important to put that in the policy because that was something that was, like you say, not being tested in our last two-year referendum. But we left it at that because we felt that in order to create those restrictions, it would create more problems than it would solve.
I have another question. On campaign guidelines and regulations, part D, it says campus organizations with an interest in the outcome of the student fee revenue may extend funds to support the position. So, to me, that would mean that putting those little vote yes things at the bottom of receipts at Charlie Brown's, or putting all the giant posters up in the student union or the cafeteria or wherever, all of that would still be okay as long as it's done by a non-general fund supply of money, like an auxiliary or something. Is that correct?
I believe that's what it said, yes.
Okay, I'm going to have to call up there because we reached our first time starting, right? So, Senator Fennell, would you like to introduce the...
Okay. So, taking the input from the first reading, some comments from the floor, as well as some comments we received directly actually out of Faculty Affairs, some of their staff were noticing that we had a difference between the sabbatical policy and the difference in pay policy in terms of workflow and where the applications were submitted. And it was our intent to have those processes be as parallel as possible to have the least amount of confusion. And so you'll see that the version of the difference in pay policy in the packet this week indicates that the applications will be submitted to Faculty Affairs, who will then take the promissory notes off of them for privacy reasons and then begin the routing. Otherwise, the routing remains the same in this week's version as the one that you saw before. We added the reference to the collective bargaining agreement that Senator Roberts, I think, brought to my attention, so that we have the proper reference there. I always tell my students, cite your sources, it's good to be called on it. And then, let's see, I don't think there's anything else in it. We also were making the end of leave report process identical in both the sabbatical and the difference in pay policy. In both cases, we are required by the collective bargaining agreement to provide a post leave report that should go into our personnel action files. And it turns out these records are public information because, you know, they're documents about what we're doing with the university's resources. And so making them posted there, makes them available without it being, you know, somebody going, having to know who to ask to get it, even though they have the right to those documents. So it makes it easy. Along the way that we do the, for instance, the postings of the departmental RTP criteria, we can always get to them and know where they are. So those are the minor changes in language, and I'm assuming that if those are problematic, we could deal with them as amendments. But I didn't think that we would need to on those. I think those are what the committee would like to approve. So returning to the issues again, we did, we've been hearing the input and considering the comments that came in last week, and we're ready to address whatever the concerns are of the Senate. Again, we're trying to make our process match the collective bargaining agreement as closely as possible. We're separating the two because the two articles are somewhat different and require different places of review and different workflow for that review. And so that's why we're doing two separate policies rather than the one combined one that we had before. The recommendations that we were making before that we have the president's authority maybe delegated to the provost, so because that makes sense when we're looking at the sabbatical funds being managed across the different schools, since it's a limited number of sabbaticals across the whole university. The provost was the one place who was actually dealing with those as they were going out. That would help in the transparency and accountability for the backfilling in those departments when those faculty members are away. Yes, with that, I'm willing to field questions.
Okay, next meeting.
Thank you. So I noticed you brought back a change to the Christian pay policy, but not a sabbatical policy, so I assume you still want us to use the sabbatical policy for our change.
Yes.
And so then you haven't made any changes to that.
My understanding is that the only changes we made were to the difference in pay, and okay. I like the sabbatical. We've been looking at the sabbatical, I guess, a little bit more closely, and then having the echo that as much as possible.
So a lot of the concerns brought up by Chair Ford about this sabbatical policy was that the new sabbatical policy does not call for the department or to be committee or the department chair to make any kind of statement about the quality of the sabbatical proposal. He was concerned that without that, that the committee would not be able to gauge the value of certain proposals of Mr. Dillon on their own. And in the DIP policy, that kind of review is allowed, but it's not in the sabbatical policy. And there, even though the chair of URTP said that the committee's experience is that the department recommendations did not sway the ranking, the concern that I share with Chair Ford is what if there are no department evaluations of quality, but the URTP committee has members of the department on it, they might not know that they are being swayed by the quality of the proposal, but since they're the only ones who can judge the quality of the proposal in their own department, they might very well be swayed without even knowing that they are swayed. So I would support Chair Ford's proposal to add that language in and if it, at some point.
There's a piece of information that may be useful here. The collective bargaining agreement does indicate that the department members are the ones to review the merit on the difference in pay policies. And the reason it goes that way there is there isn't a competition for limited resources coming from one common source. And so we do see an actual place where in the discipline you have people evaluating it. The problem we have with the sabbaticals is that we only have 12 or so, depending on the population, and the prevailing amount that comes down based on the collective bargaining agreement. Those are competing across the disciplines, and so that's why it had to go to a university-level committee, which we were identifying as URTPS. Other campuses will have just a committee for dealing with sabbaticals, and they don't necessarily have representation from everywhere. So in consultation with URTPS, this point, we actually spent a good deal of time looking at this, and I would like to defer to anyone who has served on URTPS in the sabbatical reviews for giving us some input on that. I know that Nathan Ryan, chair of the URTPS, spoke last time, but I think we have other members here who've also served on URTPS, and I think hearing from them might be helpful at this point. I would like to raise the issue that we constantly talk about our workload issues, and I see the merit of having disciplinary review, right, within the discipline. Somebody was informed on that. But I also think about, with our extremely limited resources and the amount of committees that we see everybody overextended on, we have a hard time getting people in. And then, do we get as much bang for our buck or return on the investment of our time on it? And I know that we have to sometimes say we can't do what's ideal. And I think that was the way that came out from URTPS, but I'll defer to those.
Yes. I'm a former past chair of the URTP and served on it for quite a number of years. So I had lots of opportunities to review the sabbatical applications. And I have to say that I can't think of an instance
where the department, RTP, community review had swayed the decision one way or another. And primarily because it's so inconsistent. There will be some departments where there's absolutely nothing. There will be other departments where they have a paragraph, there will be a sentence. There was really not anything there. And the times when there was something there, it was a cheerleading report. It wasn't really talking so much about merits. It was saying, yes, yes, you know, this person needs to have that. No, they don't have that. So I didn't find that particularly useful. And when we were looking at the, I'm also on FSAC and was involved in the drafting of this, and in looking at it, when we went back to the CPA and looked at that more closely, we realized that it wasn't a required aspect, and that was one area where we could deal with the ongoing issues.
Well, I have a question that's on a different aspect of this, so is that okay? Okay. I noticed that on both policies that it just says a full-time faculty unit employee instead of the tenure track employees. So does that mean that lecturers are eligible for sabbatical and VIP? And if so, I know I'm 30 now, but before, I would get a letter telling me that I was eligible for a DIP or a sabbatical from, I don't know, maybe Faculty Affairs Office. And I'm wondering, do our lecturers who are full-time also get such a letter telling them that they are eligible? And secondly, is there any consideration for the fact that when they're being judged, say, for sabbatical, that they may not have the service record or perhaps the research record of a faculty member of a tenure track faculty member because they may be, you know, working full-time, 15 units of teaching.
I'm looking around because I'm wondering, oh yes, she is here. Melinda may be able to speak to the who gets informed aspect of these things. When I was looking through at these, it says a full-time, let me get the language here. CPA, which good source. All right, so yeah, full-time faculty unit employee shall be eligible for a sabbatical leave if she or he has served full-time for 6 years at that campus in the preceding 7-year period prior to the leave, and at least 6 years after any previous sabbatical leave or difference in pay leave. So the way I read this, and Melinda can correct me if I'm wrong, if they're satisfying those, we're lifting the language from the CBA, and if they would be qualified by the CBA, we have to be consistent with that. And so if this scenario permits for a lecturer to land in that category, then I would see that it would apply to them and that they could do that. When we look at the criteria, which we're not going into changing the criteria on this one. We're trying to do a workflow, get it consistent with the CBA. But when we look at those, we do have, on this campus, we're using 30% of service, 30% of time since eligible, and 40% on the merits of the proposal. Right? So it doesn't necessarily say that somebody has to have a particular academic track record in there. And so I think that we would try and rank them suitably in each of those categories in ways that would make it as fair as possible.
Can you answer the question about we run a query and everybody that's eligible gets sent the letter. Now it's just electronic.
Yeah.
Of course, the lecturers that are eligible also get it. They have to fulfill the criteria of 6 years of full-time service to be full-time. We only have 7 full-time lecturers on this campus, so
not
talking a large number of
books.
And they have to be held to the same criteria.
Thank you. Yeah, this question kind of echoes what I had mentioned at the first meeting also. And so the concern here is regardless of what's the status of adjunct faculty would be in the perception of our tenured colleagues, and I want to refer, since it is part of our senatorial record, right? For example, in this recent exchange related to warrant these, I refer to that, and if you read then the passage that was referred to, then the former chair of one department claims that there are four full-time faculty members. Now, the former chair does not know that the department has six full-time faculty members, right? This is unpleasant, shouldn't even be talked about, but nonetheless, it's a reality. And so now when we bring this reality that we don't really know who is a full-time faculty member, even though we worked together for 20 years, when we bring this reality into the assessment of the eligibility of the semantic policy, then the question remains, since one of the criteria includes activities that the lecturer would not be contracted to do for the school, then it would probably be helpful that there is some language that recognizes that for purposes of applications for sabbatical, the same criteria apply regardless of the contractual obligations of the faculty member. So at least that we have an equal level playing field, and the merits of the proposal can be considered without giving then the review committee the option to say, well, he has or she has all these wonderful research records, but wasn't really high at point. So that's why we cannot consider that for the proposal. So simply to allow for the equal level playing field that for the purposes of this policy, just as it has to be acknowledged that it is a full-time faculty member to that, right? But nonetheless, it should also be acknowledged that whatever academic work has been done by the faculty member will be equally recognized in the application.
Can I respond to this? So I very much share the merits of that argument. And as I indicated in the memo that we brought forward with these proposals, that may warrant Senate time and discussion. That is not the intent of these two proposals. These two proposals we're trying to get aligned with the CBA as best as possible because we are currently out of compliance. And therefore, that seems to be the most important thing that we do. We want to reduce the odds of grievances. We want to reduce the odds of confusion and pain and anything else that goes with it. A next step, maybe it would make sense. And I would invite those that would be interested in working on language that could help solve this, come to FSAC and we can start working on that effort too. It seems a very suitable thing to do. But for the sake of this particular cycle, I'd like to stay out of the actual criteria for evaluation themselves and stay with the protocol and the process.
All right. Further discussion.
So on the difference in pay policy under item 3.4, it says, by the end of spring semester each year, period, faculty affairs will be submitted. Is that period supposed to be a comma?
I think so, yes. Sometimes you have the right glasses on and sometimes you don't.
Can that be moved? Because I have to actually move.
I think that's just the
friendly.
Okay.
Friendly.
Yeah.
All right, and in 3.1, it says the faculty and employee shall submit a request for a DIP leave, but it doesn't say to whom.
Well, I think that what we're saying here is the application itself is seen as a request for the DIP leave. And so, yeah.
It helps to say to faculty affairs or to the
Well, we say that in 3.2, the applicant must, I see there's then and also there. We can make.
Do I need to move that?
Well, we'd be happy to have it in there.
To faculty affairs?
Yes, to faculty affairs, because that's where we start. So let's just work with that then. That is our intention.
Okay. I have one more. You said suggestion that the provost be the president's designee, but the way it's worded is not as a suggestion, it's a policy that it will be the provost. Again, I must really be very worried. I don't think we have the authority to tell the president who he will delegate this authority to. So I'm happy if the language says something like suggest that
Yes, second. Can I speak to that?
We're not discussing that.
So I did actually approach the president on this both before, but also again after it was raised on the floor. And we understand that it does remain the president's prerogative, and we were hoping that if we had identified as the president and then in parentheses provost, that actually echoes what we see as in the final other information part that you see in 6.2, where it says the president may delegate his or her authority for reviewing recommendations from all parties and making recommendations. What we're trying to suggest is that the normal process, that the provost is identified as that person for the reasons that we explained before. 6.2 makes it clear that the president has that privilege. He can delegate it to whomever he wishes, but we recommend that the provost be the one identified to do that, and we still are leaving the president with that authority. We cannot take it away.
Thank you. Perhaps we could say president or designee for this, as you know, we keep tinkering around with policies to say, well, the next guy can change it. But at this particular moment, going through policy changes, if you haven't done it before, it's not a real treat. So I think we should keep them as generic as possible so that the president can designate. We may recommend whoever he is, but I think I'd like to support Senator. I normally would agree with Roberts. I normally would agree in trying to keep things as generic as possible. In this case, we did discuss it a bit, and I felt that it was important to make it clear that it needed to be on the academic side of the house. And the easiest way to do that was to delegate that to the provost, who then would have oversight of that budget. The provost, I don't know, can he then delegate it to somebody else? I don't know. But we did have that discussion and felt it was important to designate it to the provost. Yeah.
Okay,
can
I confirm the authority to tell the president who to delegate his authority to? If the current president is happy to delegate it to the provost, that's fine. I don't think we need to put that in the policy and have a new president who says, why does it say provost? That's not who I'm delegating it to. So I don't see what is gained by it. If the current president agrees, then it's going to be the provost. That's great, wonderful. But why do we have to, and it doesn't agree as a suggestion, by the way, it reads as policy.
Yes.
So I still think we should be moving.
Do you have any other speakers on the motion to subscribe to this? Gary? No? All in favor of the motion?
Would you want to keep the motion?
I was going to say, Senator Brennan, if I can strike, the motion is to strike the phrase.
All parenthetical references to the provost following the word president.
Okay.
So, no, that's 6.2 is where it says he has the authority.
No, the final sentence of purpose is in this policy.
Oh, well, yeah, that too. Yes. Yes, that too. Yes.
Wait.
The parenthetical references. I'm sorry. The parenthetical references, and as Senator Lewis reminded me, in 6.2 it says, for purposes of this policy, the provost will serve that role. Strike that sentence as well.
All right. Everyone clear on the motion?
It must be correct. So every place in the policy where it just says provost, you need to also replace that by just president, because there are places in the policy that it does not say president, parentheses, provost, it just says provost. So we're saying if it says provost, it should also just say president as well. Thank you.
Okay. Just a question. Are we talking about the slap the policy or the did policy or both?
I was referring to both.
Okay, does everyone understand what the motion is? I'm sorry, if you don't put or designate in there, you are
And you have the right to do this. You are moving beyond the contract and giving it to the president to do, and he may not be happy with it. So I would friendly urge you that it's a president or designee.
So my understanding is the CBA says that the president has the authority to delegate this. So that's already seems covered.
You encourage president or designee at every point. So if the Senate's wish is for the president to do the review.
No, it's just that he has the right to delegate that authority.
I think she's right.
Okay, I mean, this is a difficult motion because there's several references, and I could go through it and go through each one. I think that intent is clear. I do not believe the policy should specify that the president's designee is a provost. It might be tricky to reword it that way, but that is the intent of my proposal. Not specified.
My question to the body is, are people comfortable enough that they understand what the motion is that they feel comfortable voting on it? Yes. All right. All in favor of the motion as restated by Senator Brennan, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
Nay. Okay.
All those in favor of the motion to strike the language, please raise your hand. All those opposed, please raise your hand. None. So the motion carries. Okay. Any returning to the policy itself? Any further discussion about policy? Policies, that's right, I'm reminded of two. And the revision to the two policies. All right, all in favor of approving these two policies, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. There's unanimous. So as amended, you have unanimous motion.
Thank you.
All right, and we'll do a few reports. All right, President Armagnani, you want to report?
More further report about the consequences of the $200 million possible trigger, and basically they include a dropping enrollment by 25,000 students, dropping employment over 3,000 employees, cancellation of low and low programs, and some restrictions to the state university grant for cancellation of state university grants for graduate students. No actions were taken, and the board had instructed the chancellor to come back in May and give some possible options. Interestingly enough, the person who asked for that had been very opposed to tuition, as it should include tuition. Now we have a sort of reversal where there are more senior trustees who have been more in favor of tuition increases are saying no way, have beaten us badly on it. And newer trustees who have been opposed to the tuition increases are now saying, given this prospect of perhaps a
on the options should be a tuition increase.
It's interesting from in 60 days how things can change. Therefore, we'll be doing that. But obviously, in terms of enrollment, we are not going to accept a spring 2013 new enrollment, except in 8 campuses, which Sonoma is included, we will be accepting the SB 4040 students. Those are the students who have followed the community college program. That is a very, at this moment, small number. Less than 600, I would say, for the entire system. Probably, in our case, nobody knows, but probably a dozen or so. And then for the fall of 2013, for not this fall, before after that, the students will be put on a waiting list. Because remember, the next period, enrollment, the admission period is in the November period. And the election will happen also at that time. For all students, new enrollment will be put on a waiting list, awaiting the results of the tax increase referendum, if it gets approved and put on the ballot. We're also have been asked, people are catching up with us, all students with some exceptions will be limited to no more than 15 to 17 hours, depends on that strange mix of threes and fours. But everybody, that there will be an upper cap for most students at that point. But that's where we are, and the use of the State University grant for graduate students is being looked at. I think we're the only system in the nation to give that. And the numbers are, I was surprised. It's in the, almost, it's over $90 million in the State University grant for graduate students in the system. Those are the things that are going on, and we'll keep running and see. The governance proposal now is a combined between the proposal, which means that it has all the signatures that have been gathered before are no longer valid. And therefore, this is a new gathering of proposal of signatures to put this new measure, combined measure of the millionaire's tax to the governor's tax, sort of combined together. I just read that our own David is estimated that it might cost up to $6 a signature. If you want to get into business, get into the signature gathering business is another kind of business. And they have to build almost the end of July to gather signatures to put that back. And I saw for the first time in Southern California on Tuesday night or Monday morning or Wednesday morning, I don't remember, in a TV ad for the other tax proposition, it was called the Munger proposition. They are already buying expensive ads in the, at least in the LA market. It shows that they have independent source of money to them. That's where we are.
All right, thank you very much. But the questions will be very please.
At the risk of giving them too much credit, having thought through their proposals, if they remove the State University grant program for graduate students, are they also going to stop taking money out of the graduate tuition to fund that program?
things?
The answer is, you know, I don't know that, but I assume not. Not always. Actions have a corresponding reaction.
I have two questions. First, on the state grants for graduate students, does that include credential students?
If they are under the state university grant, that's the category that's been looked at. I don't know. I believe this credential students fit under the state university grant, but I don't know that for sure. But if they do, that's what is being looked at.
And the second question is, what is the status of the search for the vice president for student affairs and enrollment management?
It's on hold.
Is there a date?
It is on hold.
Yes.
We've got several people who are actually on the group. Do you want to respond, or do you
want to? Yeah, I would just like to say thank you for putting that out there, but I'm not the person to answer this, so I'd love to listen to the response.
Elaine, you want to just speak to this? Okay, if I may,
please.
Elaine Thumber.
This, the Mario Savio Speaker's Corner has been fully vetted and approved by the campus planning committee. We have been in very close consultation with Mario's family throughout all of this. Some of you may recall that this actually began many, many years ago after Mario passed away, and at that time the campus planning committee approved the site. And then when it was reinvigorated in the last year or so, we've been working with designing the site. We've taken it to the campus planning committee. It's been fully approved, and we've been in very close communication with Mario's widow and sons, and they're very much on board with what they're doing. So it has been fully approved. It is not through any one division on campus. It has really been a group of faculty, students, and community members who are putting forward the proposal, and it has been all approved.
That's
all.
Yeah. Right.
Senator, do you have a question? Well, I do have a question. Thank you. So I'd like to come back to the question about the DTMC. So I'd just like to report at EPC today that Dean Thane Stearns came to listen to our concerns. He just dropped in, and I'd just like to say that I think we all really appreciated his attention to the matter. We felt that he did listen to our concerns, which were wide-ranging, and seems quite willing to participate in a faculty review process, which is great, and I really appreciate that. So what I wanted to, first of all, I wanted to let the Senate know that that happened, and that was a good thing, but I also want to make sure the timing doesn't, you know, we don't run out of time, that I appreciate this intention to go through a review process, and I hope that the planning process can be sped up so that there will be time to bring this course in a proper proposal for it to the committees. So we don't have that many more committee meetings left, which is the problem here.
I agree that would be the perfect solution. What worries me is that we have an orientation of transfer students on April 9th, where they will be advised to take this course if it is in fact going ahead, because the purpose of the course is to act as a transitional course for the transfer students. And I believe that we actually have to then sign up for it 2 weeks later. So we're in a bit of a time crunch, and perhaps we can work very fast with the committee or a special session or finally here and have that decision before orientation.
Our next meeting is April 12th.
But maybe we could have a special session. We were intending to come back in our mind to talk about something about how to really get our campus to your community.
I'll let our mind.
Okay, thank you.
Two more speakers and we can cut time starting at 4. So, Senator Watt.
A quick comment, less a question, I suppose, than a concern. We got an email yesterday with the schedule of the transfer orientations and registration and so forth. And this was the first time I had seen that the cap for all undergraduates other than the incoming freshmen would be 12 units until open reg. That just seems wrong to me, that full-time status is 12 units. And given that we have a lot of students that do take five-unit classes or in the science in particular, that they're potentially going to be going into August not being full-time, that affects their financial aid, that affects their medical insurance. And I just am frightened, given how heavy a demand for classes there has been. My department didn't have much open for open reg this last semester, and so I'm worried about students not having full-time status as a result of this.
We had a lot of discussion about this in light of the system decision to cap at 16. There was discussion, should we just open up to 16 and just take it? But then I was advised that by putting it to 12, we're really ensuring that freshmen will get classes and we won't have everything filled up. And so it's a little bit like we did in the spring. We're going to manage it. We're going to look at the wait list. We're going to micromanage that. We have to put on other sections to accommodate the demand. We will do that. And I know it causes a little uncertainty for the students, but I think it's safe to say I can guarantee everyone will get their role as we did in the spring.
Yes, I think so. We can all engage in a couple of semesters of doing that kind of moving up the unit structure until open red, and we then you open up fully for students. The students will also be able, from the outset of registration, once a class builds, to go on the wait list, and they have access to the registration system all the way through May 11th. So it's not that they go in one day and they're closed out. They remain on the system. So we think that the combination of students getting their essential classes, being able to waitlist up to 8 units, and then going in during open reg early in August, that we will be able to get students up to 12 or more for a threshold of being a full-time student.
I still have people on the speakers list, but we're at our next time starting. However, we have fairly light business agenda today, so I think we'll have the chance to get back to the questions in a quick way. At this time, though, we need to move on to Vice President Metzler Phillips, because that was only the 4 o'clock time certain. So,
I have one quick announcement, and then I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Lisa Wyatt. Mark, can you please stand up? This is what a multicultural center director looks like. Very pleased to introduce Mark. He is experiencing his first day with us today, and I asked him to come here so he could actually see the real thing. He's been busy trying to get emails so you can all email him instead of emailing myself or Janet or the rest of the committee. So I'm very pleased he's here, and hopefully we have an improve on your first day. Very well.
Mark Papineau, I'm just really pleased to be here. I'm just a few hours old. I'm going to be part-time until the end of the semester. And when I finish my teaching duties at Sac State, I'll be here full-time. And I've met a number of folks, students and community members already just today. And I look forward to getting to know the community a little more and working with y'all. So thank you for the opportunity.
Glad you're here. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our director of our Counseling and Psychological Services, Dr. Lisa Wyatt.
Do you want me to start with my ear? Can you come up to the table? Why don't we make space for those? Brian, can you next slide?
Thank you. Well, I understand that there's been some questions about our fees, so why don't I just go ahead and pass these out? I'll send some on both sides here. And perhaps while that's going around, I might be able to read a brief statement that I have. Would that be all right? Very brief,
please.
I'd like to start out by thanking the faculty who strongly supported CAPS over the years. Thanks largely to the Academic Senate's resolution passed in 2008, we were able to increase our staff with the implementation of the mental health fee. Unfortunately, over the course of the past few weeks, some misinformation has been circulated that's negatively impacted our ability to help students in need. Several students, including some of my own counseling clients, have questioned whether or not they could be served at CAPS due to the misinformation, and it's highly likely that as a consequence of the misinformation, a number of SSU students in need, possibly in crisis, will not be accessing CAPS services. It's important to remember that there continues to be a negative stigma attached to accessing mental health services, especially among college students, and especially among students of color. And because my department has worked diligently to decrease the stigma, the recent circulation of misinformation has been extremely distressing and demoralizing to all of us at CAPS. Therefore, in the future, I'm appealing to you to please consult with me, one of my CAPS counselors, or your own Senator Pinkston, before making assumptions about CAPS services or the exclusions to our services. And please remember, I'm happy to consult with any of you at any time.
All right. So, we've got some information
from you, Senator Brandt. Thank you. One of the concerns I've heard expressed is, and expressed at the Senate was the new caps fee of $100 a year, of course, that would be about $700,000. I think many people thought.
I'm sorry, it's really about $820,000?
Okay, $820,000.
Based on headcount.
Okay. Yep. I think many people thought that would mean that your budget would be augmented by that amount. But my understanding is a lot of the money used to come from the general fund. And now none of the money comes from the general fund, and all of the money comes from the CAPS fee.
That's
so
right.
Your budget has not been augmented by $800,000. It may be been raised maybe
about $500,000. We were at about $300,000+, and now we're at about $800,000. So about $500,000 has been augmented.
The general fund money is not there.
The general fund money is not there. The general fund money was swept to make the budget cuts, and I would defer to Vice President Lopez Phillips to explain where all of that is.
What happened?
There you have it. Yeah. Is this pretty self-explanatory, or are there any questions about where this is?
Two questions I've heard. One is, and I don't know where this comes from, but there's an impression that there is less service available to students this year than previous years. And from what you said and in other places besides here, my impression is that is probably inaccurate. And I don't know.
That's part of the misinformation.
Is that,
yep.
And I'm wondering if perhaps some people are confusing it with the closing of the community counseling center and conflating the two as being the same. And thinking that, you know, that there was a cut there, I don't know. But it's not true that the services for students have been cut from previous years.
That's correct. It is true that it has not been cut. It's simply been articulated on our website. But the services have always been the same, and Michael can speak to that as well. You know, we don't do anything any differently at CAPS to limit our services than any other CSU or UC counseling center does not do. As an example, one of the pieces of misinformation was about substance abuse. We see students with substance abuse issues every single day. What we cannot take on are students who have addiction or dependency issues. Not only would it be not in the best interest of the student, but it would be unethical, it would be in some cases illegal for us to do this. These are very specialized services. These are services that require very specialized clinicians, very specialized physicians. And what I like to compare our limitations to, and I made mention of this in the Star article, if those of you read it, is that we are very similar to the Student Health Center. In the same way you would not go to the Student Health Center and ask one of the physicians to do your surgery for you, you cannot ask a CAPS psychologist to do very intensive, very specific, specialized services with regard to mental health. So these are the kind of services we must, if we are ethical clinicians, and that applies to any services on this campus, if you are an ethical clinician, whether that's at the health center or whether that's where we are, you will refer those students to the appropriate resources.
I just have a few questions, and I think I've been wondering how the new fee has been distributed for a long time. I know I asked Matthew some time ago about this in the provost as well. Just wondering, you know, how that fee broke down, and I think a lot of students are wondering that too. Like, they don't know what the cost recovery to the university means or why their students are paying rent. You know, it just generally,
I can't, honestly, I can't answer that because I don't know. I would have to defer to Vice President Schler because I don't know the answer to that, why we have to pay rent or why we have those cost recovery fees.
Okay, that's actually not my question. My question is that I think a lot of people are just, I know I can only speak for myself, genuinely just wondering, you know, where are these fees going? And so one of my questions then is that I got what you're describing as misinformation. A lot of people read the email that was posted that talked about this huge increase in demand for services and the consequent necessity of caps to reduce, you know, certain levels and direct students to support groups rather than one-on-one and so forth. That was in the email. Are you saying that email is not your email or was incorrect?
Oh, that's definitely, if we're thinking of the same email, but we don't direct students to support groups rather than one-on-one. So that's where I'm confused.
Is the email not your email? Or
which email, by the way, are we talking about?
It was.
There's a few emails that have gone out.
Posted on Senate Talk, and it talked about there being a 225% increase in demand.
Okay, that was an email that I circulated back in, I believe, November to some student affairs folks. And as I said, post that, and that's why it's really great if people would check this out through me before circulating information, is that those numbers were adjusted. Our increase now is about 146% rather than 225%. It's leveled off a little bit. So there have been some changes since that email, so I hope people don't, you know, take that as sort of the gospel there. That was just an email that was sent out back in November, but kind of a working for. I actually can't remember now specifically about what it said about the groups, but I don't think anywhere did it say that we would be referring people to groups instead of individual therapy.
Can I let more speakers speak? Yes. Okay. So, Anthony Galina.
Yes. Thank you. I'm looking at this breakdown of services, and I'm looking at the cost recovery to the University General Fund, which some of you might know as EO 1000 fees. And perhaps, unfortunately, as Dr. Lisa Wyatt pointed out, Vice President Schlereth is not in the room, so we cannot ask him about the EO 1000 fees. Perhaps we can ask that he, or request that he bring a report about these EO 1000 fees, or give us the opportunity to ask about them, because that's a concern for a lot of the students. As before they were on student fee money, that $143,000 was absorbed by the university. So I see a lot of questions concerning these, and I hope that we can ask questions to Vice President Schler at some point in the future.
Thank you. I have very little to say simply because Senator or Representative Galino has said it better than I. That can say.
Again, I would just say that I'm listening very closely to Dr. Wyatt. It's an issue very close to my heart, as it is to yours. So I attend to it very closely, and I know that November email did delineate, and I don't know if that's which parts are true, which parts are no longer true. I think as a community, or at least I am interested in finding out which parts of that email are true and not true. You know, it did delineate, well, because of the student demand, we can't do this, we have to divert to here, these students can be helped, these can't be helped. And so I don't want to...
What's your question? I'm sorry.
To be able to know which aspects of that email that was produced in November describing the necessity to reduce certain kinds of services as a consequence of the huge increase in demand are still the case for the campus.
I don't have that email in front of me, but I will tell you that because of our demand, we have had to enforce a lot of those limitations.
Right.
Quite definitely, yes. The only thing different about that email, by the way, is that 225% increase is leveled off to 146. Everything in there should be pretty accurate.
Sure.
I'm a little uncomfortable having a conversation about an email that we don't have in front of us.
Right.
Especially when the stakes are kind of high and it almost sounds like there's some accusations of things aren't being true with the email. I don't think it's an appropriate conversation.
It'd be great to have Larry Sharp here to talk about the university cost recovery detail, but I just would like to point out that part of the cost of running the counseling psychological services is having a place for them and electricity in that place and telephones and things like that. So just because it doesn't go to cover to pay somebody's salary doesn't mean it's not a legitimate cost of running the program. And you want to understand these fees are supposed to cover the cost of running the program. Didn't think they were allocated specifically for human resource costs of salaries and wages.
I'm just curious about the CMS fees. Do you use CMS to attract students, or I'm just kind of curious how your office uses CMS?
Well, of course, we have to approve absences, time reporting, and that way I have to use CMS, for example. There are occasions when we use CMS to look up a student.
No. I'm going to speak very loudly, even though you're next to me.
Okay.
To what do you attribute the spike in demand?
Well, I think there's a few variables in that equation. I think number one, if you charge students a fee, they will come, right? So I think once students realized there was a mental health fee, they thought about maybe accessing mental health services. However, I think that only explains partial increase because we've been seeing a steady rise for several years now. Michael will attest to that. We've been seeing a steady rise for several years now. And I think the economy is probably another maybe like 30% of the equation. We have students that are extraordinarily stressed out. We have students that are extraordinarily apprehensive and anxious about the future. Students whose parents have lost their jobs, divorcing, alcoholism, foreclosure on their home, you name it. And now they're accruing mounds of student loans and not really the promise of a $50,000 a year job when they graduate. So there's a lot of anxiety, there's a lot of apprehension. Again, that only explains a portion, though, of the equation. We've been seeing a very steady rise in anxiety disorders even before 2008, the stock market crash and the economy tanking. This is another part of the equation is that we have the millennial generation and they're a little bit less likely to cope well with anxiety and it's kind of a perfect storm, really.
All right. Yeah.
Thank you. Again, and you might have touched on this, Dr. Wyatt, earlier in your first initial reading of that report that you had written. But how many counselors, and I'm looking at the positions, Mark, on the services page that you passed out, how many counselors were there prior to the fee, prior to the students taking the fee?
If you count me, 3. If you count me as a 0.5, 2.5.
And so now, if I'm looking at that, we have at least 2 or 3 extra, or maybe even 4 extra people.
We have about 6 FTE now.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Dr. Wyatt, following up on Senator Wilson's question, would you be aware if such an increase in the number of students who need psychological services is also noticeable in other campuses?
Or? Yes, absolutely. In fact, I'd be happy to, at some point, provide you the new AUCCCD, the national survey, is due out, I think, in the next couple of weeks. This is very definitely a national trend, public and private.
Is there then, may I follow up, is there an obligation from our side to make an appropriate report to the state health agencies that there is some kind of attention given to them?
Oh, I do contribute to that report. Yes, I am one of the statistics in that report. Yes.
All right.
Another quick question for all. Are all these counselors, you ones, almost equally qualified? Are they all
in a study? They're all psychologists. All but two are licensed psychologists. And the other two are postdoctoral counselors. Nobody is at a master's level. Everybody's postdoctoral.
All right. We have another concern that the board wants.
Before Dr. White leaves, I want to thank Dr. White for doing a tremendous job of changing from a state side to a defunded program and then managing all that. It's tremendous work the council has done. Particularly as we have more staff, one of the things that she did say that I'm particularly proud of, and she should be proud of too, is the proactive approach with running some of the groups to support our students before they get into crisis. And so it's with that kind of staffing, even though we, as you see and have heard, we probably could use more in what's going on in our society. But that's been a great change, and I think a support for students.
Thank you. Right, we've got a minute or two. I'm going to give people a chance to ask questions directly for our West Coast and Coach Ventura.
I'm asking about the article on the front page of the Star today about colleges may ask students for their sexual orientation at AB 620. I wasn't sure whether I should be asking you or one of our other colleagues here. Are there plans on this campus to ask students to report their sexual orientation on applications for admission? And if so, will there be a prefer not to state option?
I have not heard yet, but I think that's going to probably be with the provost. It's going to be with our enrollment management at the chancellor's office. And I haven't heard anything from my group, the vice presidents, about this, or I don't know if you've heard from the provost.
This is a legislative proposal. Therefore, it would have to be, nobody will implement that on their own. It would be, if that law passes in our legislature, there is about 12,000 bills. This is one of those 12,000 bills that have been submitted in this session of the legislature.
Thank you. All right. So our portrait of Uncertain is here, and so are the people who are here to help us talk about it. We've got some guests from the Theater Arts Program. We have a thematic program going next year, and they'd like to talk to us about it. Does that work?
Yeah.
You want to come on up to the table?
Well, we can just stand over here if you like.
Yeah. It's in your pocket if you want to.
So, hey folks, thanks for making time for us. Some of you I know, some of you I know. I'm Scott Borstein. I teach in theater arts and dance.
I'm Claudia, the director of the SSU Field Station Foundation. We'll get to me later.
Yeah. So we'll just take a few brief minutes of your time, but this program that we're working on for next year is something that we've spoken to Ben about, and he thought it would be a good idea to have us come and share a little information. As mentioned, there is information in your packets about sort of what's underway. So what it is something called Waterworks. And Waterworks is something that the Department of Theater Dance has been working on and that we're really looking for cross-campus partners with, which would be a season next year, 2012 to 2013, throughout the full academic year, of exhibitions, performances, and coursework related to the theme of inland water flow as a resource, as an image, and as a metaphor. Now, this is obviously a hot topic in the state and in the world in general, and by pure serendipity, of course, it makes sense, it's in the zeitgeist that the Science, Tech, and Math FYE is looking at exactly the same topic next year as well. But what we're looking to do, we have, certainly in our department, we have all the plays and some of the dances that we're going to be performing as part of our department season for next year, all very specifically target this theme. And the idea is to look at this theme of inland water flow as a way to leverage cross-campus collaboration around the theme. This is a subject that came up at the faculty retreat at the beginning of this spring, and there seems to be a certain amount of interest and hunger for this kind of thing. And this is something that we just happen to have been working on for the past couple of years, but the idea is that we don't, as a department, certainly we don't want to just be performing for the sake of performance. We want to speak to the world, to academia. We want the things that we're working on to relate to what people are studying and teaching. So to that end, all these various plays and dances will be relating to inland water flow. As one play, The Great Divide, deals with the question of hydraulic fracturing or fracking, which deals with the water table. There's other more mythic, poetic relationships to water. We have a play that we're actually going to perform out on the lakes out there. We have operas that are related to water and so forth. But that's just the performances. We're looking for ways to invite people to be doing similar things in their classes or be exploring similar themes. And we're trying to build up the sort of a marketing procedure and a website for Waterworks that would really advertise and show all the things that people are doing across campus. So we've already had some conversations with some folks. We know we're going to be collaborating with the Science, Tech, and Math FYE and having their students attend performances, creating greater public exposure for lecture series that they're working on. For example, Raina Laney in Geography 340 has retooled that course so that it includes a greater water component. We're going to actually be looking to link that with a theater class so that students have an interdisciplinary experience of working both in geography and the theater. I'll pick on Richard just because I see him and because I know we've had the conversation. We talked with the anthropology department of their undergraduate student research forum, perhaps being focused on the idea of water and culture, perhaps having some of our students who have not participated in that, but who do research work, participate in that. I know we've also talked about your introduction to linguistics class and how water relates to culture and so forth. So we're just looking to sort of help give some ideas. What we're hoping for is that this will be of interest to people with their different classes and programs around campus, and that as you come up with various ideas, you can say, hey, we're interested in connecting with your performances, or if you're not interested in connecting with performances in R at all, that's just as well. If you're interested in exploring this topic, know that it will be part of a cross-campus conversation, and that we can help recognize those efforts through crossover marketing and the information that we're putting out there. Let me just take a minute maybe for Claudia, if you want to add in a little bit.
Yeah, I just wanted to say why I jumped on it, why I thought just generally this was a really neat model that we might want to consider for the future as well. So I'm, of course, really interested in this topic coming from more of an interdisciplinary background from the preserves, and it's an environmental issue. And I think that there's a lot of advantage in all of our different departments, like you said, collaborating, working together, this new theme. But also, sustainability is one of our strategic themes for the SSU campus. And water is one of those key sustainability themes. We might want to consider a multiple year, each year coming up with a different theme in sustainability in which we all, as part of our ongoing practices, not creating something that's hugely new, but that we just tweak things that we're doing to a little bit to so that we suddenly have a campus-wide event happening. So one of the things that I really loved about this model is that we have this kind of grassroots approach, you know what I mean? We're not creating this huge additional amount of effort of everyone. It's not a new event. It's not anything that we're trying to find resources in order to do. we're having each of our individual departments and people and programs come up with something that's just water-related or sustainability-related, and then packaging it all together in a poster or in a logo or something like that. So for a very little bit of extra effort on all our parts, we can then present to the community a unified academic vision of what it means to be interdisciplinary exploration, in this case, water. So I just wanted to put that out there that it might be great, something for all of us to try this coming year to see where our individual programs can dovetail kind of water in it, but you know, dovetail into this program and see how it works. And see if we can advertise the things, various activities to the community and get a new thing going.
Right. And so, just as a last word, if you're interested in exploring this further, in your packet, there's information about specific events across campus that are already lined up to be part of this, or specific courses that are already lined up, or specific exhibitions. If you're interested in just having a day in one of your courses that's about water in some way, about inland water flow, or if you already have that in your syllabus, let us know. You can contact me. My information's on the first page of that packet, or Paul Draper, our chair, who's been as present in putting this together as I have. If you're interested in bringing a class to see an exhibition or a performance, we have online study guides and a lot of classroom support in place so that it doesn't have to add to your prep load, right? And if you're interested in getting even more involved in that and, you know, having your class do an exhibition or a presentation or something, let us know and we'll try to help with that crossover marketing we've talked about. So thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, some people have missed it. All right, we've got a lot of reports left. I want to go back, we have a two-person speakers list that was questions for the provost. I'd like to finish that up and then move on to the report, okay? So that was the next. Do you remember my question?
I know. You talked several times about some course. It sounds like maybe half of us know what you're talking about, and the other half of us, Maya, don't know at all what you're talking about. So I thought maybe you could have a brief description of what it is exactly people have been talking about.
So I presume you mean the Dean's course, I think it's being called. This is a concept, a thought, that the deans could put on a course for transfer students in the fall in the Green Music Center. It would accommodate a very large number of students, between 800 and 1,000 perhaps, on a trial basis, very experimental. The deans would volunteer their time. They would each teach for 2 weeks. The provost would be willing to put 2 weeks into it. And there would be a uniting theme, which would be something like exponential changes in the last 50 years, and each of the disciplines would showcase what those changes would be in technology and education, etc. It would be a C2 upper level course, and the intention would be in the first attempt to really work with the students coming in who are transfer students who could have a transitional experience, if you like, and really get to know what the schools do, what the capabilities of the different schools are. It's something that deans have been wanting to do since I got here, and because we could really do with doing something about the bottleneck for that particular upper gen ed, then this seemed like a good time to try. But it's not a done deal, and we're still
discussing. I get it, that part.
My last thing was a question for the Douglas was Sandra Shands. Sandra, do you remember what you were?
I want to get on to the rest of the reports because I want to make sure we actually get to this. I'm not going to be like Ben and be able to photograph an hour earlier. All right. Executive Vice President Rainey, have you got a report for us?
Yeah, thank you. AS elections, so far, student government elections wrapped up.
yesterday, and the results were announced, so I wanted to bring those to you. They're posted on the student union windows, both upstairs and downstairs. But I'm going to go ahead and read off the names, if it's okay, of who the victors were. I'm going to, first of all, extend a hand of congratulations to Mr. Andy Guino, who will be our executive vice president next year. So you all have a great time. AS president will be Karen Paniawa. Vice president for finance will be Adam Gorley. The business education senator will be Michael Booz. Arts and humanities senator will be Dana Denisha. Social science senator will be Alex Barker. Science and technology senator will be Mallory Rice. Statewide issues senator will be Patrick Maloney. Sustainability senator will be Nelson Lomeli. Student services senator will be Chelsea Nascimento. The diversity senator will be Ariel Abo. Development senator will be Gina Marie Bishop. And the community affairs senator will be Bernadette Bukovic.
All right. Any questions?
The only other thing I wanted to draw your attention to are these cards that are on your in front of you. This is the ASB and President-elect event calendar, student event calendar for April. It's celebrating Asia Pacific Heritage Month, and there's a really great set of events that are coming up, so please keep right on with those.
I want to apologize for my colleagues. They're all laughing because none of us can speak. even with our glasses.
Just a brief question. It has come to my attention that AIS used the services of a particular surveying company, right? And that there's some kind of strange result patterns that would be difficult to explain. Is there any intention to follow up on that, or is it a closed chapter and you just going to reconsider that to use a different service for it?
We switched to an online voting system last year. For the first time, we used to do paper ballots, and last year we went to an online system. And to the best of my knowledge, I haven't heard of a strange set of results. We have had some students come to us and say they had trouble finding the ballot. Usually it's because if the ballot gets emailed to them and they've set up the spam, their email filter, so that they spam out all the things that come from the university that they don't like. So, we are trying to figure out how to solve that problem. To the best of my knowledge, it hasn't, I mean, just as far as the program structure goes, we haven't had any real issues, to the best of my knowledge.
If I follow up on it briefly, in one instance, a candidate was happily engaging in campus activities to make her candidacy known, and it so turned out that a candidate who has not had any presence whatsoever would receive 70% of some 1,500 votes. Is that unreasonable to assume that a known candidate, as opposed to an absolutely unknown candidate, would have a high market?
I haven't heard that story.
Okay.
I think there's a whole bunch of explanations, but to the best of my knowledge, it hasn't been anything systematic. But I mean, it's a new system, so we haven't had any problems so far, but if there are those concerns, please bring them forward. It's really important to us to be fair and
equal.
Thank you very much.
All right. Statewide Senator.
Yep.
A written report.
I have a report that should be copied for you. The Statewide Senate met on last Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. You can see all of the resolutions that passed there at the top, and then towards the bottom of that first page would be of interest to the campus senates, because these are the resolutions that are first reading, and now go back to the campus for any input. One has to do with resolution calling for the banning of sale and distribution of tobacco products on CSU campuses. The next few, C, D, and E, I'll have to defer to Catherine tonight because the introduction of those. Then on the next page, there's a resolution calling for the review, if there is a policy, or the creation, if there is no policy, on maritime faculty. There's varying campus eligibility criteria and so on. Then there's another resolution. This has to do with the online education that opposes the use of the Western Governors University model as a model that would be looked at. And the next one is support for accessible and affordable open source textbooks. And then the rest I would also defer to Catherine. In regards to the Cal State Online, it continues to progress. They have a really, they've launched a new website, which I encourage you to look at. There's lots of documents on there that are very informative. No decisions have been made. And the goal is to provide access. You remember that faculty trustee Shane was here, but she was also visited San Jose and San Francisco. She's continues to be a very good presence on the board and will continue to involve to the campus as well. Chancellor Reed spoke to the Senate. It was just at this point that I got off the left. Because people may have thought it was like some sort of political statement, but I actually had to come home early to do a rehearsal. So a lot of what he said, President Armenian has already gone over, having to do with the taxes and the enrollment capping. And the, on the next page, the third page, you can see about the grants for these CSU grants for graduate students, and just some other things highlighted here. Executive Vice Chancellor Ephraim Smith spoke to us about these ongoing initiatives. The graduation rates are showing some improvement, as is the achievement gap seems to be lessening. 1440 is moving forward. There's two new TMCs. Music is one of them. And there is a need for reviewers to look at the CID courses. I'm actually doing this for music, and I would encourage people to do this if you have the time. It's interesting, and it will help get these transfer model curriculums moving. The governmental relations person spoke to us, and they're going to be mounting a big effort for campus delegates to speak. Instead of focusing attention in Sacramento, focus attention more with locally with legislatures and do advocacy that way. They will be sending us a packet of materials, brochures, and talking points. Things that we might want to, that we should address with these legislatures. I think the rest is self-explanatory on the back page. John Travis, the CFA liaison, indicated that the CFA is preparing for a strike vote. I think the rest is self-explanatory. If there's any questions, Catherine and I
would be happy. Yeah, I was thinking you might be interested in on the resolutions introduced in first reading
It's on the back of the first page, kind of procedures for dealing with voter no confidence. I don't remember what they're called, but the task force that was appointed to look into ways of trying to deal with some of the concerns about the perceived problems with shared governance proposed a couple of resolutions, one of which is just procedures for dealing with voter no confidence, and it's a request that the Board of Trustees establish a policy for addressing those votes of no confidence directly, and it's in first being formed out. And it has to do with establishing a committee and looking into it, and then if that doesn't work, going for a formal Board of Trustees review. I'm going to bring it back to you in second reading, but it's coming directly out of Sonoma State's more conference resolution regarding budget and academic issues in the chancellor, and I thought you might be a little bit proud of that. The second thing I wanted to mention, just two comments that were made, one by Chancellor Reed and one by Peter Huber. Chancellor Reed, in talking about how to deal with the budget, another comment he made was that we may be facing looking at combining programs or eliminating programs on one campus and maintaining programs on another in places like Southern California where students can get from one campus to the other in 15 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever. Nobody can get anywhere that fast. You get the idea. But the idea would be that why would every single campus within driving distance of another campus in Southern California all have a political science program, for example? Or why would they all have an environmental studies program or chemistry program or whatever? So given the really serious threat to, or even ongoing serious threat to CSU, that might be something that the administration recommends we look into. And several people under the chancellor have been mentioning that to us for 3 or 4 months now, so that may become a reality. And finally, on the very back page of Brian's report, Tim Huber came to talk to us about the gaps in participation and success experienced by male students in CSU as opposed to their female counterparts. And one of the comments she made, almost a direct quote, is the result of her research indicates that male students have inflated self-confidence to the best that they have. In all seriousness, the evidence that she has looked at, male, young male, I guess, upcoming college students tend to enhance their overconfident. They overstate their ability to think they're better than they are at certain kinds of skills, particularly with regard to study skills. And they don't have habits of women. And this goes to young women. This goes back to what happens in senior year of high school. Men play computer games, male students play more computer games and engage in more things like that. And females do, they tend to spend more time taking notes and studying. So I thought you might, I don't know, enjoy that. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. I hope I'm not overplaying my comments. But it's in reference to the first readings, the resolutions introduced in first reading section I. My question, Dr. Nelson, is what is this a request that from the statewide academic senate asking that there be a procedure, a policy? Because it's my understanding that they wouldn't have any real power in delegating such responsibility to the Board of Trustees or the Chancellor. This is just merely a request.
It's a request that the board set up a policy to establish a process to respond to votes in the conference. That's what we'd like. We're not telling anybody we don't have the power.
Sure. Well,
we're requesting that we have, let me rephrase that. We have the intent.
Yeah.
We are requesting that they establish some kind of policy.
Thank you very much.
On item F on your first meeting, on the new creation of campus policy on the maritime faculty, just wondering if they're looking at anything about disabled faculty who retire for disability reasons and may not, you know, may have different criteria, the same amount of time as other faculty. Did that come up at all, or is it mentioned in terms of faculty who must take a disability retirement?
Brian, is this your resolution?
I'm sorry.
No. No.
Okay. I'm sorry, I thought you wrote this. This is a, to my recollection, to the best of my recollection, there is no specific mention of disability in the recommendation. It's just a very general a recommendation, making sure that maritime policies are in place. There was, as I recall, some concern about establishing criteria and making sure that they are implemented consistently across individuals applying for their benefit. Not the fault of the village.
All right. Yeah, under resolutions passed without a second reading on A, I presume that the 1870 was not opposed because of the mandate setting aside some of the increased fees for financial aid. Was that concept, was that overshadowed by other more negative aspects of 1870?
I believe the, as I recall the discussion, the main concern behind this resolution and the main reason why people, based on the conversation about the resolution itself, was a concern about legislative, overall general concern, more general concern about legislative interference with the CSU being in control of financial affairs, as I recall. The arguments also have to do with the fact that the CSU already sets aside a substantial amount for financial aid, but that distribution flexibility of that and inclusiveness to respond to the services.
Okay, in short time, I'm going to let Pastor Wicker give the CSA report because he requested to be able to give a report and then also to sing us in the weekend and the meetings we can after that.
CFA Chapter President Merrifield is at a planned mediation session at the Chancellor's office today and Friday and asked me to present his report. Andy addressed the Board of Trustees Tuesday to report on bargaining. CFA will continue to put forth proposals in good faith. They're very concerned about the lack of progress in this space. CFA has certain principles they will not abandon, but still want a mediated settlement. CFA continues to hope and work for a mediated settlement, but will not abandon faculty rights, and that is why they are preparing to exercise those rights if and when the statutory process fails. At the Board of Trustees meeting, he observed the following. The Board of Trustees Compensation Committee, following the recommendation of the Chancellor, decided to give the two new presidents the maximum salary increase allowed, 10% above their predecessor. This was not required either by the policy adopted in January nor by Robert's Rules of Order, as strangely suggested by one of the trustees. Trustee Ockenberg said she was only sorry that it couldn't have been more. But the decision was not unanimous and was cited by members of the trustees, the governor, other elected officials, and media as demonstrating once again the disconnect between the chancellor, who made the recommendation for the highest possible salary, and some of the trustees. Finally, the scenario for gutting much of the university reported in the press by the chancellor and his vice chancellors was based on a request by the trustees at the January meeting as a worst case scenario. It is not inevitable, even if the revenue initiative passes, and as I believe President Marmiano stated in his report, the board requested that the chancellor staff come up with other alternatives. If there are any questions, you can contact Andy by email and he will respond with 9 minutes.
Just a couple quick items. We will be bringing forward to XCOM next week, so we're hoping it'll appear on the floor the following week here. An addendum to the conflict of interest policy that we have. It's responding to some new requirements for the National Institutes of Health, their public health service grants. In order for us to receive funds from them, we have to have this whole new procedure in there. The language is completely boilerplate, so it's, do we want to get their money or not? And so we're going through the process of doing that. So be looking for that the next time. And also, we're currently working with the Professional Development Subcommittee on working on some an interim charge for the committee, because the current charge indicates that they're supposed to be supporting the director of the Center for Teaching and Learning. We don't have such a director, and therefore we're trying to just say, what can we do with this committee in the meantime? So that will be coming before the executive committee next week as well, if we get our memo in order by Monday, whatever, by Monday prior. So that's our business committee. If you care about PDS and what they're doing, feel free to contact me or Heather Smith.
Do any of the chairs of the other standing committees have a report? Can you do it that way to make sure they see?
Sure. So we are moving along on our two tasks. We have two working groups, one which is updating the current MOU with Extended Ed, and the other is crafting the online instruction policy. We have come, I believe that the MOU is almost done, and that should be, that comes here, right?
First
goes to XCOM and then here. The online course policy has been crafted and it's currently under review by various units such as CFA, IT, Disability Services, and Academic Freedom. Once that is done, then we'll come here.
Great. Any others?
Yes, it's very quick. First, as was pointed out, there is an easier-to-read version of the activity, so you can pick this poster up for the Asian Pacific Heritage Month in the ISP office, which is just at the bottom floor of the student unit. And then just want to mention that there are two other things happening in April. Earth Week, and there's another poster, is April 16th through the 22nd. And then as part of the April activities, you'll also see listed Disability Awareness Week activities, which run from April 23rd to the 27th. And in particular, there is, on the 23rd, I must announce this, Diversity According to Family Guy in South Park with Matt Glowacki at 7:30 is supposed to be quite interesting, and it's talking about diversity in two favorite programs that ought to be very interesting to our students. And then the following day, on Tuesday, he's going to also do a workshop more related to disability issues.
Thank you, Senator Shen. Shen's out.
On this poster, there is a mistake. It says Friday, April 12th. It should be Thursday, April 12th. Not a big deal, but there is an event on Friday, April the 15th.
All right. If any of our items should go to the orders. Hearing none, I say we're done.